So today's discussion at Torah Studies is all about clothing. We're going to talk about the history of clothing, the symbolism of clothing, and the Kabbalah of clothing, and it's all based on, all centered around the clothing of the clothing that the priests would wear in the Mishkan. This week's Torah portion is Tetzaveh, and we speak about the priests and what the priests wore. Are you finding it? Fantastic. Okay, good. So it's all about the clothing. Open up your chamashim, the good and condition, to page 532, 533. All right. Amy, you have a copy of a place? Yeah. Mike, you want to slide down? Slide down here. Or over there, wherever. Okay, you're good? Okay, so let's jump in to the Torah portion. Let's read it inside. Mike, we're going to get you started. You've come back heroically, triumphantly, along with Amy. We are so happy to see you. Please get us started, Torah portion, Tetzaveh.
533?
Yep.
And you should command the children of Israel that they should bring to you clear olive oil, crushed for lighting, to ignite the lamp until it burns continually. In the tent of meeting, outside the partition that is in front of the Ark of Testimony, Aaron and his sons should arrange that it has sufficient oil to burn from evening to morning before God. This is an internal law for the children of Israel.
So the Torah portion Tetzaveh opens up by talking about the oil. The oil for what? To light? What are they lighting? The lighting of the menorah. So it talks about a very brief discussion, two verses about lighting the menorah. After that, it segues to talk about the priests. Remember, last week we began our discussion about the Mishkan, the tabernacle, by talking about how to build it, what materials you need, what vessels, what items are in the Mishkan, how you create the walls and the tapestries. All of those instructions and directives were in last week's Torah portion. This week we move away from the structure and we focus on the actors, who plays a role in the service in the Mishkan. And the answer is the priests, the Kohanim. And here the Torah talks about appointing the priests and the priestly garments. And as you'll soon see, the garments, the clothing of the priests, becomes this major focal point of the Torah portion. Let's continue. Mike, if you don't mind continuing, chapter 28, verse number 1.
When the tabernacle is built, you should draw Aaron and his son, a brother, close to you, together with his sons. Aaron, your brother, close to you, together with his sons, separating them from the children of Israel to serve me as priests, i.e. Aaron, Nadav, and Evihu, Eleazar, and Ishamar, Aaron's sons.
Okay, so that's the priestly family, the original priestly family. Continue, please.
You should make holy garments for your brother Aaron for honor and splendor. You should speak to all the wise-hearted people whom I have filled with the spirit of wisdom, and they shall make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, so that he can serve me as a priest. These are the garments that they should make: a breastplate, an apron, a robe, a checkered tunic, a turban, and a sash. They should make holy garments from the materials which were consecrated to God for your brother Aaron and for his sons to serve me as priests. The one who make the garments shall take donations of the gold, the turquoise, purple, and crimson wool, and the linen.
So here we have, thank you, here we have items that are clothing items that need to be made. We have a breastplate, an apron, a robe, a checker tunic. That's a tunic with a complicated past. A turban and a sash. I was joking about that. Okay, so these are some of the items, and there are others as well, and they should all be made from those various materials, those various items: gold, turquoise, purple, crimson wool, linen. In fact, in many of the garments, there was gold that was actually woven into, gold threads that were woven into the garments. Okay, we're going to kind of like paraphrase the next several pages in the parsha. So let's look at it together. So here we have a discussion about the apron. Okay, continue 537, the settings and the breastplate. So you can see some pictures of the apron on that page. Turn to 539. Now we have the picture, the image, not the picture, but an image, depiction of the breastplate. On 541, we have the breastplate mounted on the apron. So now we have a, a combo package, right? The apron plus the breastplate. And then we have on 543 discussion about the robe and the forehead plate, which again are depicted in the illustrations beneath the page. And on 545, we finally talk about the tunic, the turban, the sash, and the pants. These are the last four garments that all priests wore. So let me explain. A regular priest, not a high priest. All of the Kohanim, all of the priests wore four garments. And these were the tunic, tunic's like a shirt, the shirt, the hat, turban, the belt, sash, and the pants. So a priest serving would wear pants, right? Which is a good thing, wearing pants, a shirt, a belt, and a hat. Mazel tov, you're ready to roll. A high priest, in addition to that, would wear the other items we cited before, we listed before. And those were the apron, the breastplate, the robe, which is an additional body covering, and the old forehead plate. Can't go wrong with that. The tzitz, forehead plate, that adorned the high priest. All of those additional four were only worn by the Kohen Gadol, by the high priest. So a high priest wore eight garments in total, and a regular priest wore four garments. Fantastic. Let's read a little bit about the tunic, the turban, the sash, and the pants. All right, Amy, please read 545, right there in the middle of the page where it says, you should make.
You should make the checkered tunic from linen to be worn under the robe. You should make a linen turban. You should make a sash, the work of a professional embroiderer. For Aaron's sons, only four garments should be made. You should make tunics. You should make them sashes. You should make them high hats, turbans, for honor and glory, and make them pants, as mentioned below. When the eight garments described above, you should clothe Aaron, your brother, and his sons along with him with four garments. You should anoint Aaron and his sons, inaugurate them in office, and sanctify them so that they may serve me as priests.
Okay, so here we have the bottom line is, and it continues for a little bit, the point is that there's a lot of discussion about the clothing. And you would think, like, do we need to cover this? To really, like, get into all the detail? We need to know exactly what they wore and how to make it. Are we creating it? Like, what's going on here? So a lot of detail about the clothing. So our central question, the central question of today's class, or the central theme of our class is going to be, channeling my inner Jerry Seinfeld, what's the deal with the priest's clothing? Like, what's going on with that? Why is that such a huge topic? Why does it take up the majority of this week's Torah portion? In fact, it goes all the way to the next page. And on 547, we have a discussion about the inauguration of Aaron and his sons and that process. And that kind of goes for a few more pages to the end of the Torah portion, which means that the majority, at least page-wise, as we're turning pages of this week's Torah portion, is all about the garments, what they were, and how they were made. Now, to explore the theme of the garments, here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at a key phrase that is found in the discussion that we actually just read. A key phrase that explains the purpose of the garments of the priests. So open up your Torah studies books, please. Open up your Torah studies books. Let's see what page it's on. In the booklets, so the class begins on page 104, and really what I want to pick up is, actually, look at text 1, if you don't mind. Look at text 1, although text 1 we actually already read. Mike read it before. This was the first half of the reading from Exodus 28. But I want to highlight one pertinent verse or paragraph. Look at the second paragraph of text 1. Do you see that? It says, you shall make holy garments for your brother Aaron for, what does it say?
Honor
and for glory. In other words, when we ask the question, what's the purpose of the clothing? And obviously, the priest had to wear clothing, but why so intricate? And why these clothing? And why do we have to have this whole long-winded description about exactly how they were made and what they were made of? when trying to understand the secret of the garments, the Torah actually gives us a clue. And it says, what was the purpose of the garments? What were they for? Lechavod ulesifares, for honor and for glory. So I'll ask you a question. What does that mean to you? What does that mean to you? How do you understand that phrase where it says that the priest, the garments were for honor and for glory? How do you, what does that mean for you? Anybody? Whose honor and whose glory?
God's honor and glory.
Anybody have a different opinion?
I didn't hear the answer.
For God's honor and glory.
I have another. For the priest.
Okay.
Distinguish themselves from the...
Possibly. Yeah. Anyone have any another angle?
The priest's honor and God's glory.
Okay. Good. It's a little hybrid action. Anybody have another opinion? By the way, everything that was mentioned so far, you can find the commentary that says it, and we have it here in this class.
I think it's regular B'nai Israel.
So you're saying that it's an honor for them. Okay, good. And we'll see how there is an opinion that talks about what it does for the people and how the clothes actually benefit the rest of the people that aren't priests, that are not serving, which we'll get to actually in a moment as well.
It identifies these people as honored by God as his special servants.
Fantastic. Who needs the commentaries when we have this class of incredible scholars? We got it. Let's go through it in turn, starting with text number 2, Nachmanides. Take it away, please. Text number 2, page 106. And you'll see how each commentary has a little bit of a different twist to explain the very same phrase that says these garments are for the priests. Why? For honor and for glory. What does that mean? Text number 2.
For honor and for glory, so that Aaron will be honorable and glorious. By wearing honorable and glorious clothing, so does the prophet speak of the bridegroom dressing like a priest and clothes of glory. These garments bring glory because they are royal clothes. Kings would dress in the fashion in the days of the Torah. So we do find that in Joseph's fine tunic, which bore a similar pattern as the tunic worn in the temple, as I have explained, was worn by the kings of the East. The mitzvah hat worn by the high priest is likewise familiar today amongst the great kings and princes.
And amongst the great bakers. I'm joking.
So too, the ephod, Aaron and the Hoshin breastplate are regal clothes, and the tzitzit.
That's the tzitzit is the forehead plate, or show plate.
Show plate is a kind of a crown worn by kings. A deeper meaning of honor and glory is to say that these holy garments should be for Aaron to serve them in honor of God who dwells among them, and whose glory is in their might, as the verse states, "For you are the glory of their might." It is also written of the temple to glorify the place of my sanctuary and the place of my feet I will honor, that the site of the sanctuary should be glorified with beauty, and that the place of my feet, which is the site of the temple, should be with the honor of God.
Thank you. So let's distill Nachmanides, Ramban, into two simple points. He says two major ideas about what the garments were for. Number one, who can tell me what's the first thing that he says? What's the first honor and glory? Who is it honoring and glorifying?
Aaron.
The priests, right? We dress them in royal clothing as an honor to them. These are the priests. These are the big kahunas. These are the ones who are the spiritual leaders of the people. They should dress in fancy clothes. We dress kings, and we dress princes, and we dress royalty in a regal fashion. So we dress, Jews dress the priests in a regal fashion. Lechavod ulitefaret means, on a very simple level, for the glory and honor of the priests who are serving. Yes? Number one. What's the second point that he mentions? Number two. He has 2 points. A deeper meaning. What's the deeper meaning of honor and glory? Of whom?
God.
Of God. This is God's house. In God's house, if you are the misharet, how do you say misharet? If you're the servant in God's house, you dress appropriately. If you dress in street clothes In the palace, you're disrespecting the king. This place is a home for God. And in a home for God, you have to dress with a certain type of decorum. So the priests wore fancy clothes, not only first reason for their own honor and glory, but to honor and glorify God, whose home, so to speak, they're working in. Make sense? Mm-hmm. So again, two different points. It's important to understand and have clarity as to what he's actually saying. Number one, it's for the honor and glory of the priests themselves. It honors them. They have a high position, so we dress them nicely. And number two, it honors God. It honors God by dressing nicely in his home. Fantastic. Text number three, the next commentary. Dan.
For the honor of God, since they are holy clothes dedicated to serving him.
So he says a little bit of a different twist on it. It's still honoring God, like the second opinion, the second explanation of Nachmanides, but it's honoring God not necessarily because we're dressing the priest in nice clothes, but he used the language holy clothes. They're holy clothes dedicated to serving him. In other words, the fact that you use different clothing exclusive to service means that they're special and exclusive. In other words, you don't dress in regular clothing, you dress in distinguished clothing, not necessarily because it's fancier clothing, but because it's different, it's very different than normal clothing, so it designates it as holy clothing. That's first opinion. That's his first angle. Continue, please.
For glory, so that the Kohen should inspire all who surround him with awe, for they are his disciples, engraved on his heart and upon his shoulders.
So the Sfarno explains in his second, it's not really two explanations, he's explaining both phrases, for honor and for glory. For honor, the honor of God, special clothes for God, and for glory, to create and instill awe within the people. When the people see the priest serving with such grand clothing, they can't help but feel like, wow, this is a special occasion, not occasion, this is a special setting, it's a special service, it's a special, these are special people, and they will be instilled with a sense of awe and fear and decorum and reverence for the temple service. So we have now three different opinions. It's for the priests, the clothes are for the priests, the clothes are for God, the clothes are for the people. Yes? So far so good? Is it clear? Yeah.
S-I-T-E.
Where are you?
It's also to glorify the site, because it's
the site of the temple, correct. Well, hold on. The set of the things, right. And the site. In other words, it should glorify God that in his home, as I mentioned before, in his home should be honored with people wearing nice clothing. So it also honors the site as well. You're right. So it honors the priests. It honors God. It honors the temple. It honors the people, or honors or glorifies or creates awe, but it's for all the above. Fantastic. Take a look at the chinuch, text number four. You're basically getting a tour of classic, a tour, T-O-U-R, of the classic Rishonim, the classic early commentaries, early biblical commentaries, explaining the meaning of these words and the purpose of the garments.
The message of this mitzvah is the principle established for us, namely that a person is impacted according to his actions and pursuant to his thoughts and intentions. The representative who atones on behalf of his people, namely the Kohen, must attach all his thoughts and intentions to the divine service. Therefore, it is appropriate that he wear special clothes for it, as when he stares at any place of his body, he will immediately remember and be aroused in his heart to remember in front of whom he is serving. This is akin to the mitzvah of tefillah. We are commanded to place it on a part of our body so that we have a ready reminder to maintain proper thought. Though the priest also wears tefillah, due to the greatness of his matter, he needs the priestly garments too.
Okay, what's the chinuch's explanation? A different angle. What does he say? Who's it for? Who are the garments for?
The colors.
The him. But why? Is it like Nachmani says, to give him honor and give him glory and make him look nice, or something else?
What he's doing, so he'll stay.
Keep him focused. It's a reminder. He wears special clothing to remind himself that he has a special task. He's playing a special role. He has a special position. Right? He's got a special job. So he doesn't wear, again, he doesn't wear street clothing, not just because we want to honor and glorify the persons, the people who are serving God, but it's also for the people themselves, the Kohanim themselves, to remind themselves what they're there, what they are there for, and what they're all about. Make sense? What we see here is something fascinating. If we take a step back, you know what the implication is? The implication is, and here's the big idea, that clothing is powerful. Think about it. When you want to make a statement that somebody is honored and noble and royal, what do? Give them different clothing. When you want to make a statement that God is special and revered and this house is special, what do? Change the clothing. When you want to make a statement, when you want to create a sense of reverence amongst the people, that people should take the temple and the service seriously, what do? Change the clothing. And when you want to remind someone of who they are and what they're all about, you know what you do? Dress them in different clothing. Clothing is powerful. Clothing is paradoxical. On the one hand, it's very utilitarian, right? Clothing, fine, done. It could be like Adam and Eve. What did they put on? Fig leaves, right? Hey, it could be simple. So it's simple and basic. Yeah, we make it fancy, we make it different, whatever it is. But on the one hand, you could say, who needs the fashion? Is Baba Mises. It's all utilitarian, on the one hand. On the other hand, what we've seen so far, and it's all stemming from the Torah, these are all commentaries, legitimate, genuine, authoritative, divinely inspired, according to our tradition, biblical commentaries that explain the significance of the clothing of the priests. And it matters. It changes, it creates awareness, it changes perception, it has an impact. Clothing is not incidental or purely utilitarian and functional. It's not just clothing serves a function. Yeah, we need to cover the body, so we put on clothing. Clothing creates impressions. In fact, there have been studies that show that people that are not doctors, when they put on a doctor's coat, and then they take a battery of tests or quizzes or whatever, they do better, they pay more attention than those that are not wearing the clothing of a doctor. Somehow, you know the joke, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. Somehow, that act of assuming the garments of a doctor actually impress upon a person a greater sense of deliberation and concentration and care in their analysis. Nonetheless, right, doctor? Where's your seat? In honor of today's class, you got to totally bring, huh? Yes, two doctors, right, exactly. In honor of today's class, you guys have to bring.
And I'm the quack.
So, the message here is, it's not a message. The point is that clothing is very powerful. It's not just incidental, unimportant. Clothing has power. Clothing changes the way we feel about others, the way we view others, the way we view ourselves. And we all know this to be true, right? You wake up in the morning and you feel in a certain mood. And so either you dress in accordance with the mood, or maybe you dress in the opposite of the mood to change your mood. You ever do that? You're like, I'm not feeling so cheery. Let me put on something that looks cheery to make me feel cheery, right? Yeah. So there you go. I put on like a blue something shirt and a jacket and I'm good to go. I'm kidding. I always wear that. But the point is that, right, we put on something that makes us feel a little bit, maybe a different mood. Text number 5. It also has Talmudic origins. Talmudic origins, text number 5.
Rabbi Yochanan called his garments my honor.
He described his own clothing as my honor. In other words, the things that give me honor bring me honor. Apparently, he would dress in nice clothing, and he would say that my clothes are giving me kavod. They're honoring me, or they make me look honorable, or others honor me in part because of my clothing. However we understand it, clothes played an important role in his honorable position. or in his honorable state. Now, let's talk about some of the power of clothing in Jewish history and Jewish thought. The first story I want to tell, or the first story we have here, is text number 6, Talmud Tractate Brachot. And here we go. The Talmud explains on the topic of the power of clothing that King David once messed with clothing, and so Mida, Keneged Mida, which means
measure for measure.
Measure for measure, thank you. Measure for measure. Clothing turned against him later on in life. What's the story and what's the consequence? The story goes like this. King David was the up-and-coming Jewish hero, military force, general, warrior, all-around superstar. King Saul was not so happy, because King Saul was the king. And here everyone's like, whoa, David, what's he doing? Right? All the paparazzi was around David. And Saul's like, can I get some photos here? I'm kidding. But it was kind of like that. So King Saul developed, and we have to understand these stories also on a deeper level, but on a very surface level, you read the scripture, you read the books of the prophets, and this is what emerges. Saul became jealous of David to the point that Saul wanted to kill David. And he had his army try to seek out and find and kill and execute David as an enemy of the state, enemy of the king. To make things even more complicated, King David, before he was king, the king was Saul, David married Saul's daughter. Awkward Thanksgiving. So there you go. So it's not only the king, it's his father-in-law. And they had worked together because David was Saul's general in certain battles, right? David and Goliath, this is before he became king. He slew the giant Goliath. So there was a lot of stuff. But for a little while, Saul was actually pursuing David to kill him. At a certain point in time, in midst of this cat and mouse game, so Saul is pursuing David, but he goes to sleep. He lays to rest in a cave. They're like, you know, it's happening in the mountaintops, hilltops. And King David comes across King Saul, who is trying to kill him. And we know Jewish law tells us that if somebody's trying to kill you, you're allowed to defend yourself. And maybe one would say, even if he's not actively awake and holding, you know, a sword or a bow and arrow, whatever that, probably swords, right? Even if that's not happening, maybe, you know, he's the king and he's calling the military, calling the army to kill him, maybe he would be allowed to take his life, but he didn't. Instead, he takes his sword, David does, and he cuts a corner off of Saul's garment while he's still sleeping. And he knows that when Saul awakens and I'll see that cut, Saul will say, I know who did that. It must have been David. And either it'll be a wake-up call, stop pursuing me, or I could have killed you, back off, or any number of messages, but he wanted to deliver a message. But what did he do? He cut the garment. He defaced the garment of a king. The Talmud says, text number 6, check out what happened. Julian.
Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe secretly. Rabbi Yose, son of Rabbi Hanana, said, whoever treats garments contemptuously will in the end derive no benefit from them. For it says, now King David was old and stricken in years, and they covered him with clothes, but he could get no heat.
When King David grew old, he was cold, and he could not get warm. Even when he wore clothing, layer upon layer upon layer of clothing, he remained cold, freezing. The fact they hired, you know what they did? Yeah, Isha Shunamit. They hired a woman to lay with him, not in an intimate way, but just physically to create body heat for him so that he could exist and not in a state of shivering. The point is, and that worked. The clothing didn't work. The Talmud says, why didn't the clothing work? Because he disrespected clothing. He wanted to deliver a message to Saul, but what did he do? He cut the garment. Because he cut the garment, garments later on didn't work for him.
Yeah, but David had a lot more trouble than just his cutting Saul's garment.
What in the world might you be referring to?
I mean, things, you know. So
are you referring to Bathsheba?
And this is and Bathsheba's, you know, husband, who he then
sent to the front line.
Yeah. And you know, so there's, I mean, David had issues.
Hold on one second. The Talmud says whoever says that David sinned is mistaken with Bathsheba. So we've had a class.
Yeah,
on that.
I remember that.
Right, strength and struggle.
Yeah, strength and struggle.
So there's a class on that, and the angle is he had justifications for what he did, because the fellow didn't. He was the king then. David was king, and the fellow didn't listen to him. He said certain things, and the fellow totally disregarded. Remember, he said to go home. He's like, I'm not going home. I'm staying here within the palace. So whatever it was. So there were justifications for sending him whatever. And he had written a writ of divorce to his wife, because that's what all the soldiers did. All the soldiers wrote a bill of divorce before they went out to battle. Look, there are technicalities in which we can say it wasn't, you know, there were justifications. On the other hand, he himself lived with repentance for the rest of his life. So he certainly owned it. The Talmud says clearly that the fact that he was cold was related to the clothes, that incident cutting the clothes that happened before he became king, and not related to the Bathsheba incident. So your point is well taken, but this is limited to that. So it says, mida kenega mida, measure for measure. He disrespected the clothing disrespected him, and didn't work for him. Yeah.
I just have another question, because I can understand all the reasons that clothing, you know, is powerful and it's not just incidental. But then I also think, well, suppose one of the righteous is a homeless person, you know, on the corner, who's, you know, looks like, you know, a mess.
I mean,
there's a little bit of...
you got to bring the tunic and the sash and the pants and the hat.
But nobody in the shmata business has respect for clothing. If it doesn't sell in 45 days, it's shmata.
Right. You got to change your style. I hear you.
It makes so much of the outward appearance seem to be so much more the focus than what's inside.
Right. So today, you know, I wrote in the email, it's not what's on the inside that counts. It's what's on the outside. That was my title and subtitle for the email. It's not what's on the inside that counts. It's what's on the outside. We'll see Kabbalistically, as we're talking about the Kabbalah of clothing, we'll see how that rings true. What you're saying is certainly true. And that is that it could be somebody doesn't have the clothing, doesn't have the fancy clothing, and is in truth inside a noble person. 100%. And yet, we find that God, in his own book, said that Kohanim are noble. They're very special. They play a special role. They honor me. They honor the people. The people need to honor them. They need to honor themselves. And therefore, for all of the above and more, therefore, dress them with these nice clothes. We don't see that God says, you know what? Make people recognize how special they are, even in plain clothes. No, they're dressed with nice clothes. Your point is still correct. It's still, you know, well taken. Nonetheless, this is what we have here.
I believed you, and I wore a silk Michael Kors blouse tonight.
You see that? You see that? Unbelievable. Special clothing. Okay, so we have one story about the power of clothing from King David. Let's take a look at another text, classic Jewish text about the power of clothing, regarding the Exodus from Egypt, text number 7. David.
I will free you, and I will deliver you, and I will redeem you, and I will take you. These four expressions of redemption which God uses to foretell the exodus to the Jewish people correspond to four factors of merit.
In other words, God uses four language of redemption, and according to the Midrash, it's because the Jews earned their own redemption in the merit of four things that they did.
Throughout their slavery in Egypt, the Jews did not alter their language. They did not change their mode of dress. They did not reveal the secret that the Jews were going to leave Egypt and take its wealth with them. As it is stated, a full year before the Exodus, Moses told the Jewish people that Each woman shall borrow from her neighbor, and they did not abandon the practice of circumcision.
Four zchuyot, four merits did the Jewish people have. Number one, they continued to speak the holy tongue, Lashon Kodesh, Hebrew. Number two, they did not change their dress. Number three, they did not tip off the Egyptians as to what would happen. And number four, they kept up the mitzvah of Brit Milah, of circumcision. What we see here, the second point of merit, the second element of merit for the Jewish people was, although they may have walked like an Egyptian, they did not dress like the Egyptians. Walk like an Egyptian, right? You gotta do the token song. They did not dress like the Egyptians. They did not talk like the Egyptians. They didn't dress like them. They didn't abandon their mitzvah of circumcision, and they didn't divulge the big news about the Exodus and the cleaning out of the wealth of Egypt. Fine. What we see here again is the power of clothing. So clothing is powerful. It creates an impression for self. It creates an impression for others. It creates, well, in King David's instance, honoring clothing is beneficial. Disrespecting clothing is the opposite of beneficial. And finally, clothing was part of the merit that actually brought about the redemption of the Exodus of the Jewish people. Fine. What we're going to do now is talk about clothing in halacha, clothing in Jewish law. Where do we find clothing or aspects of clothing mentioned in Jewish law? Again, clothing is something not disregarded in Jewish thought and not disregarded in day-to-day Jewish law. Clothing is something that is talked about and mentioned. The first reference will be regarding the clothing that we wear on Shabbat and holidays. Text 8a.
It is incumbent upon everyone to make an effort to obtain attractive garments for Shabbat, each one according to his or her capacity. For one must honor the Shabbat with fresh attire, as stated in section 242.1. Also in the prophetic tradition, it is stated, and you shall honor it by refraining from following your ordinary ways. Our sages interpreted that phrase stating, you shall honor it. This implies that your Shabbat garment should not be the same as your weekday garment. Instead, you should change to another that is more attractive. The basis for this interpretation is that a garment is called one's honor because it brings honor to a person. For when a person comes to a place where people do not know him, if they see him dressed in distinguished garments, they will honor him. If it is possible for him, it is desirable that he have a second talit for prayer, for Shabbat prayer. There are men renowned for their good deeds who are meticulous not to wear anything on Shabbat that they wore during the week, not even a belt, pants, or an undershirt. It is desirable to wear at least some of one's Shabbat clothing throughout the day until after Havdalah on Saturday night. The same need to honor Shabbat with appropriate attire applies to the festivals to an even greater degree.
How amazing is this? How detailed, also. Jewish law, halacha, oh, it's everywhere. It's got a lot to say about a lot of things. So what do we have here? So we have this teaching that Shabbat has to be, it's an honorable day. You have to honor Shabbat. How do you honor it? In part, with what you wear. It's an honor day. Fantastic. Wear something nice. And in fact, the honor of the day should be distinguished from the mundane aspect of the rest of the week, which means that as Shabbat is coming in or before Shabbat comes in, make a point to get out of your weekday clothes and get into some Shabbat clothes. And Shabbat clothes should be one notch up, a little bit nicer. Again, it's amazing, right? For a religion or a belief system that values so much the inside, look at how much is put on the outside. It's incredible. That's really the whole point of this class, right? To see how much emphasis is put on the outside. Shabbat is coming, so what should happen in Shabbat? Here's my thought, right? Without this, it would be meditate and study and focus on God and family, and who cares what you're wearing, right? Just focus on the true on the deeper things. And yet, owning up to, being honest to the power of clothing and the impression that it creates, halacha says, get another set of clothing. And by the way, this was taught in a time at a time when people didn't have walk-in closets. A walk-in closet was called a home, right? A walk-in closet and a master bedroom that was bigger than some of the homes in the shtetl. Yeah, put those things, those two together. A walk-in closet was an impossibility, and it wasn't possible. They didn't have the room, nor did they have the clothes to fill it up. They may have only had two sets of garments, one for the rest of the week that they washed throughout the week, and one for Shabbat. Here's my point. We live at a time when most of us, Baruch Hashem, thank God, have many, many, many different sets of clothing. Certainly we can have a special set of Shabbat clothes, or sets of Shabbat clothing, because you can't wear the same thing 2 weeks in a row, right? That's terrible. Again, I always say it's easier to be a guy, especially like a rabbi. Like, okay, white shirt, long black coat, done. Next, hat, prayer shawl, next, right? Come on, it's easy. But anyway, the point is that when Shabbat arrives, we dress in nicer clothing. Why? It's part of how we honor Shabbat. It's part of how we demarcate, distinguish between Chol and Kodesh, between the mundane and the holy. Part of that is how we dress. And what's interesting is, I love that paragraph or that statement that says, try to wear nothing at all from your weekday garb on Shabbat. Not your shoes, not your socks, not your, I'm adding, right? Not your belt, not your tie, not your shirt. It should be totally different set. You only pull it out on Shabbat. Even a tallit, a prayer shawl. You're only going to wear it in the morning service. How long is the morning service? Even with a long sermon. What is it? We do 9:30 to 12. What is that? 2.5 hours. 3 hours. I need a special prayer shawl, another prayer shawl for 3 hours a week. Yeah. Yes. Get another prayer shawl. Make it special. Make it different. Clothes create an impression, even though it could be construed as just the external, just the outside. Text AB is pretty much following along those lines. You know what, Anne, just read this as well, please.
So too, one's clothing for the festivals must be better than one's Shabbat clothing.
We've just upped the ante. Now we say, right? Now we say, when the festivals come around, oh, now even better than Shabbat clothes. So you thought Shabbat clothes were fancy schmancy. Wait till you get to the festivals. By the way, I will tell you, it's a custom that some have that husbands purchase for their wives jewelry and clothing for Shabbat and festivals, etc., something special on occasion throughout the years. However it's done, whether you buy it for yourself or someone buys it for you or with you or, you know, whatever it is, the bottom line is we're supposed to dress in a special way. Now, let's take a look at the next area of clothing or the next area of Jewish law that pertains to clothing. And this pertains to what happens when we buy new clothing. Alex.
When one buys a new house or new utensils, even if one already owned a similar item, or if it is a repeat purchase, the blessing of the Shehecheyanu is recited each time. This applies even if the item isn't technically new, even if it's old, and it is only new to the purchaser, who has never owned it before. New is only meant to indicate that one did not sell and then repurchase the item. For something that is not especially notable, like a shirt or shoes or socks, the blessing needs to be recited.
Need not be recited.
If the buyer is poor and does in fact celebrate the purchase of this normally unimportant item, they should make a blessing.
So what's interesting is here again we have the Code of Jewish Law, Shulchan Aruch, and it says that there is a custom to recite the Shehecheyanu prayer, Shehecheyanu blessing, which is thanking God for something new upon the purchase of new clothing, special clothing. So there's a discussion. What happens if a shirt, what are the examples? Shirt, shoes, or socks, no big deal, right? So I don't say the Shehecheyanu. But what if it is a big deal to you because, not to you, to someone who is who's impoverished, then maybe they should. Other opinions say they shouldn't. It's a big debate and discussion about whether you should or shouldn't. But the point is that there is, again, an element of joy, something special regarding clothing. We're going to skip 9b and 9c. Again, this gets into a debate about the Shekhyona with clothing. Typically, I'll tell you, Chabad custom is we err on the side of not reciting the blessing unless, look, what's a fancy, let's speak about men's clothing, or actually, no, women's clothing. What's a fancy designer, like a really expensive designer that if you got that dress, it would be like incredible.
Balenciaga.
All right. Let's, okay, Gesundheit. Whatever, however you pronounce it, right, however you pronounce it. So if you get that, how much, what is it?
Like $50,000.
That's exactly what I was looking for. If you get one of those bad boys, right, you get a $50,000 thing, then we may let you throw a Shekhyono in there because of the joy, right? The joy, Shekhyono is a prayer of joy, and the point is, though, it can apply to clothing as well. Clothing is something special.
Would it be the cost or would it be the purpose? Like, what if you buy a wedding gown?
Possibly,
you know?
Yeah.
Or, but which is probably expensive too. But I mean, what if it's something
right.
You know that
notable
cost
for that?
A lot,
yeah.
But you know,
I think
like
it's about
baby's first shoes or something.
Right. Again, Chabad custom is typically we don't go crazy with that Shekhyono. Oh, baby's first shoes. Hey, speaking, he doesn't have shoes, right?
No,
he doesn't need shoes.
Yeah,
he's still too young. We're talking about Eli, the baby, the baby. We'll figure it out. No, so the point is that typically we don't. Chabad custom is not. Okay. Some people, though, it's a little bit subjective here, like how you feel about it.
Okay.
Fine. Now, let's take a look at this. We have another law pertaining to garments, text number 10. This is a classic favorite.
You shall observe my statutes. You shall not crossbreed your livestock with different species. You shall not sow your field with a mixture of seeds, and a garment which has a mixture of shatnez shall not come upon you.
Don't wear the shatnez. What's the shatnez? Wool and linen together. If a garment is comprised of wool and linen, keep it on the shelf or on the rack. Don't purchase it. Don't wear it.
I've never seen one.
Wool and linen?
Well,
so here's the deal. Wool and linen, you actually do have situations where even if it's not on the label, it's actually there. Linen, apparently, is a stronger fiber or thread or whatever. Sometimes in men's suits, especially European suits, they use it, and there are lists you can find online that have more problematic for men's suits, at least, that's the ones that I've looked at, which are more problematic, which are more prevalent to have linen. So if you buy a wool suit, there could be linen threads, for example, over here in the collar. To create a stiff type feeling to stiffen up the collar. So there could be linen threads, and they have Shatner's laboratories, Brooklyn and Baltimore and even Atlanta.
I would put buckram or something else.
I'm just saying. So they have Shatner's laboratories that go in and do a, what would you call it? They do forensics on it. They do tests on it. They cut out a little piece, and they examine it under microscopes, and they give the verdict.
Speaking
what? Listen, I can't comment. I don't know enough about it. I'm just saying it definitely happens. Now, text 11A.
Why
text,
are you not allowed to put the two?
Wool and linen? This is a statute. It's a chok. We have no... There's no rationale given in Torah. It's one of those things where it says, so we don't do it. That's it. It's like acceptance, submission to divine will. Now, how do we get dressed in the morning? I'm glad you asked. Is there a procedure? Oh, you bet your bottom dollar. Text 11A. Yeah.
Everyone should be careful to put on his shirt properly, not inside out, so as to show the unbecoming stitches, lest people look down upon you.
So number one, get dressed like a mensch, right? Yeah, you're a little, you know, your head is in higher places, and you're thinking about Torah, and thinking about all these big things. You know what? Get dressed like a mensch, right? Wear the clothing the right way, the way God intended you to wear it, right side, you know, not inside out. All right, 11B, continue.
It is appropriate to hold both sides of a garment in one's right hand and to put on the right and then the left, keeping in mind that everything is included in the right side and from there proceeds to the left.
Like if you're putting on a shirt or a jacket, you put on the right, you put in the right first, or a pants or whatever it is, always the right and then the left. Continue.
We find that the right side is preeminent throughout the Torah, for example, with regard to the right thumb and the right toe of the Kohanim in their initiation rites, with regard to the purification of a metzorah, as well as the chalitza ceremony. Hence, when putting on shoes, too, one should also accord precedence to the right side by putting on the right shoe first.
So when getting dressed, this is important. This is daily Jewish law. Daily Jewish law. Put your shirt on, not inside out. Put it on the right way, number one. Number two, put on the right side first. What if you're a lefty? What if you're a left? Oh, that's text 11C. You're jumping texts. Hold on, we got one more. What if you're a lefty? What's interesting is it doesn't tie it into your dominant side. It ties it into the laws of the Torah that speak about rituals that are done on the right side first, which wouldn't change based on if you're right or lefty. So, I don't know. I'm not an iter yet. I'm not a lefty. But and we'd have to look it up. I'm sure it's a very clear-cut thing. Huh?
Is that, where in Torah is
the right quote? You just read it. The right toe, the initiation rites. In this week's Torah portion, it talks about, or what?
The right?
Yeah, you sprinkle blood on the right thumb, on the right toe, at the mitzora, chalitza ceremony, it's the right. So would it change if someone's a lefty? It doesn't say that you do right because of the dominant. Yeah, because that's a separate thing. Because it says, no, it goes the opposite way. It says to put on your weaker arm, so that whatever is your dominant arm, you do the opposite.
Text
for tefillin. Yeah. Now, yeah.
Hand washing.
That does change if you're right or lefty. You start with your right if you're right. Then you just throw the water in the air and put both in multiple times. See, this is why you're here. See, you missed this. Right? You see what you've done? Huh? Yeah, no, it's good to have you back. Right? So, I don't. You go by how what you normally write with. Normally write with. You, even if you write, well, no, right, but if you took a pen or pencil in your hand. When you did. I don't know.
She used to write on the blackboard in class.
No way. Both?
No, she'd be writing with one hand, and she'd go back to the board, and she'd be writing with the other, and drove the students crazy.
That's wild. That is wild.
But I can't remember in the mornings which hand.
Right. I would say if all things being equal, based on the value of right over left, chesed over gvur, etc., I would go right, unless there's some overwhelming evidence to the contrary. One more text, 11C, and then we're going to talk about the Kabbalah, and then we'll close it out. 11C,
okay.
You're going to look for one more. This talks about tying shoes, which is different than putting on shoes.
With regard to tying tefillin, we find that the left arm is granted prominence, for tefillin are bound upon it.
And that's for righties.
Hence, with regard to tying shoes as well, precedence should be accorded to the left, and one should not tie the right shoe until he's put on his left one and tied it. Only then should he tie his right shoe. With regard to the shoes worn in our time that do not require tying...
He's referring to Crocs. I'm joking.
Have you seen those smart basketball shoes?
Yes, the Nikes.
Yeah, you just put them...
Those are amazing.
Yeah,
I want to get me some of those. There's an app. Yeah, you...
Yeah, you eventually put them on, and it, you go to the app to activate it, and it ties the shoes for you.
It's
preferred tightness.
It's amazing. And it can be even active as you're playing. It can, keep...
Yeah.
Crazy.
Oh, my
Continue.
God. With regard... Oh, man, hold on. Let's see.
Yeah.
With regard to the shoes worn in our time that do not require tying, one should put on his right shoe first, for prominence is given to the left only with regard to tying, as with tying of tefillin. Similarly, when one takes off his shoes, he should remove the left one first, thus showing deference to the right.
And it's getting complicated, so let me explain. It's actually fairly simple. So you always get dressed, right side first, whatever it is, and including shoes. You put your right shoe on, you put your right shoe on, you put your left shoe on, and then while you're at the left shoe, you just do the tie, and then you move over to the right shoe. So it's right on, left tie, right tie, right, left, right. You with me?
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
it's the old pattern.
And then opposite.
That's it. Oh, and then when you take it off, left foot. No, you would untie the right shoe. then the left shoe, it doesn't say that, but I'm filling in the blanks. You untie the right, untie the left, take off the left, take off the right, and after that you're exhausted because you just spent so much brain power trying to figure out how to take off your clothing that you're like, I'm exhausted, and you end up sleeping in your clothes, which is not honorable, and then all bets are off. One final point, which is a beautiful, beautiful idea, and there are so many powerful texts about this that we're going to skip. But the good news is you have a copy of the text, you have a book or a handout, take it home and read through them all. I'm referring to texts number, 12, 13, 14, 15a, 15b, and that is it. So I'm going to paraphrase all of those texts, all of those pages. I will tell you in short what it says. Kabbalah also has an understanding, a notion of clothing, and it's not exactly the same thing as these clothes, but there is a similarity. You see, one feature that differentiates clothing from you yourself is that you are you and your clothing is not you. And your clothing you can change. You can't change you. You can change your clothing. Correct?
You can.
Well, that requires surgery.
No, human nature.
Yeah, but not so easily. Well, hold on. Wait. I'm speaking still physically.
Oh.
Human beings and clothes. Not yet. Oh, I'm sorry. I mean physically. And I know you can through surgery, but without extreme measures, right? You are you. Your body is your body. Your clothing, though, you can change. You can take this one off. You could put this one on. You can wear nothing. You can wear everything. You could change different things around. Whereas when it comes to your actual person, it's pretty much that. It is what it is. Fine. The same thing is true with the soul. The soul parallels the body in this way. There's the soul itself, the body of the soul, to mix metaphors, the actual soul, and then there are the garments of the soul. So there's the nefesh, the soul, and the levushei hanefesh, the garments of the soul. What's the difference? The soul is comprised, the soul itself, in Kabbalah, the soul itself is defined as ideas and feelings. And the garments are what you think, what you say, and what you do. And there's a difference. The difference is, like the difference between the body and the physical clothes, is the difference between the soul and the garments of the soul. You see, sometimes you might be in a situation that naturally causes you to feel arrogant, egotistical. That might be your natural reaction, your natural soul reaction. Good. You may not be able to change that, but you know what you can change? You can change the garments. You can modify and modulate the garments that your soul puts on. In other words, you're feeling proud, okay? It's not always so beautiful, right? The idea of pride and arrogance. Okay, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to nominate yourself for Person of the Year or not, right? Maybe you hold back from that. What are you going to say? What are you going to actively think about? You and I have power, have control to modify the garments. Give another example, maybe an easier example to relate to. A person gets angry. Not no one in this room, right? Obviously, present company excluded. But certain people, right? People sometimes get angry. The question is, are you fixated on the anger? Do you keep on thinking and ruminating and percolating the anger by mulling it over in your mind, thought? Do you speak angry words? Do you do angry things? Or do you hold back, not do anything, not take revenge, not say anything nasty, and push it out of your mind and move on? You see, we can't change our natural soul reaction. That's like the body. The body is the body. You can't change the body. Maybe through intense work, you can change that. You can change that. I won't get angry. Things that have pushed my buttons for decades suddenly won't. Through extreme soul searching and personal change, it might be possible. Perhaps, and we can't rule that out. But for most of us, to try to change yourself in such a deep level, that's the long-term project. What's the short-term project? Change your garments. You're thinking ugly thoughts, angry thoughts? Wonderful. Recognize it. Own it that it's negative. As the author says in Tanya, Doche b'shtei yodayim, push it out with two hands, not with one hand. And yeah. There's one way where you go like this. You push it away, but you're like, actually, I wouldn't mind, right? Like, oh, I really should not be thinking about that, but it's really actually enjoyable to feel that anger. Huh?
But sure, it's fun.
Right? what to be, to think.
Whatever you're thinking about this thought.
Right, exactly, right. So you push away, b'shtei yodayim, with two hands, from your thoughts. You don't say anything. No one has to say something. You're not forced to say things, right? In fact, Jewish scholarship says that God gave us two walls to cover the mouth, the teeth, and the lips. And we still can't keep, can't modify and correct our speech. Not we can't, but it's still difficult to do so. And finally, action. We can control what we do. Again, all of this is mentioned in these texts. And the key point here is that whereas certain things about us we may never be able to fully change, there are a lot of things that we can change, that we do have control over. We don't have control over our essence, if you will, the inside, but we have control over our garments. We can change our garments. The Alter Rebbe introduces in Tanya an incredible idea. He says that the goal of life is not to become a tzaddik, a perfectly righteous person. That might be aiming too high. The goal is to become a beinoni, average. However, his notion of average is pretty high. What's average? Average is, in the inside, you're flawed. Inside, you feel things you shouldn't feel. You want things you shouldn't want, right? Inside, it's complicated. Inside, it's messy. But the garments that you wear, you always dress nicely. When you're speaking to someone, you speak kindly. When you're doing things, you do the right thing. And even in your mind, which is the hardest, it's the hardest to keep those garments clean. Even in the mind, anytime you notice a negative thought, destructive, right, etc., a negative thought come to mind, like I said before, you push it away. We have the ability, the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, the premise of the whole book of Tanya is, the premise is, every single human being, even a flawed human being, has the ability in thought, speech, and action, in the realm of garments, to be pure and to be holy. Holy garments, Batman. And so, this is our calling. Our calling is to make sure our garments, like the high priest of yesteryear, our garments should be noble, should be beautiful, should be regal, should be royal, even if inside we know or we feel like we are imposters. Be a hypocrite. We may have said this a few weeks in a row. I think we may have said this last week or maybe at a different class. Be a hypocrite. Feel one way inside, feel flawed, act perfect. Don't worry. What's the worst that can happen? Other people think you're perfect. You create a perfect world. What's the worst that can happen, right? You be a model for others. Be an example, a mentor for others. It's fine. We're not expected to be perfect on the inside. That we may never be able to change and perfect. But on the outside, the garments that we wear should always be perfect. And in this way, the Alter Rebbe says, we create a better world. We create a better world by feeling however we feel inside, but putting on our best face and our best soul garments and making a difference out there where it counts, in action, in speech, and in thought. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies. You guys are such a polite audience.
Does not mean, though, that if you